side. And all them crazy murderers would never run from inside. You try to keep me down cause you see no joy. All them knows them from, so you call a man a boy. I ain't a toy, can't just see, open up your eyes.
The thing that makes Judaism dangerous to everybody, to every race, to every nation, to every idea, is that we smash things that aren't true. We don't believe in the boundaries of nation state. We don't believe in the ideas of these individual gods that protect individual groups of people. These are all artificial constructions, and Judaism really teaches us how to see that. In a sense, our detractors have us right in that we are a corrosive force. We're breaking down the false gods of all nations and all people because they're not real.
And here we go, folks. It is Monday, December the 14th, 2020, and you are listening to today's edition of The Ugly Truth. Welcome to the program, folks. It's good to be back with you all. Yes, we are a day late, folks. Again, as you know, my personal family situation is such that I am tied up most of the time dealing with a lot of family something, and so because of that, I don't necessarily get here in front of the microphone. And besides that, given the importance of today's date and what is taking place right now as we speak, I thought that I would wait and see which way the tide was turning in that regard, rather than have you wait an entire week to find out what it was that I thought about it. And of course, what I'm talking about is the fact that today is the day where the Electoral College meets, and this is the big day. So far, as of just a few minutes ago, it looked like the fix was in, and that Biden is going to or was going to secure this stolen election in his favor. But as we'll talk about later on the program, folks, I still believe, as of this moment, my prediction is that when January the 20th rolls around, is supposed to be inauguration day, that Donald J. Trump is still going to be sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania. Now, Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, whether or not he's there because all of this has been adjudicated in his favor, or whether or not, as I have predicted on this program, that we are going to see so much upheaval that he is going to be forced to take drastic steps. And of course, by that I do mean martial law in order to quell the problems that we're going to be dealing with. That obviously remains to be seen, but by no stretch as of this moment is it over. Anyway, a quick programming note. Again, I am planning on hoping and planning on going to 2 days a week on the program. We're just going to have to wait and see how things go, as we have talked about, and whether or not there's even a system in place in order to keep this thing going. And on that note of keeping things going, number one, I want to thank the handful of people who have risen to the challenge and have sent a few dollars our way in order to cover the costs associated with putting this program together and the website and all of the rest of that. My sincere thanks. And to those of you out there who would like to contribute to the costs associated with putting this program together, simply you can email me at theuglytruthradioprogram@gmail.com. Let's see, there was something else that I needed to touch upon. Oh, yes. Okay, so the website, folks, there is a function on it now to where you can put your email address in, just like it was on the former website before it was shut down by the anti-free speech usual suspects. So you should sign up, put your email address in there. You'll get an email notification every time something new comes up, including these programs. And that way, you won't have to email me to say, hey, are there any new programs yet? So just sign up for that, and then you will get an automatic email notification. For the new listeners to this program, if this is your first time joining us, just a note of explanation, which I've been doing now in the last couple of programs, which is the introduction to the program. Of course, you know, the music is important because that was the theme song that was used by our good friend, the much-missed Mike Piper, on his five-night-a-week program over at RBN for 5 years. That was his opening and, I think, closing theme song. And because I worked as closely as I did with Mike for many, many years, and really he was my closest colleague, and I consider my work to be basically a continuation of his, although obviously I could never fill his shoes, but nevertheless, my meager attempt to do that, that's why I elected to keep the tradition going of using that song. Now, more important than the opening song, folks, is that sound bite. And yes, I'm going to hit on this on every program, not only for the benefit of those who are new coming to the program, but as well for those who are the regular listeners, because in that little sound bite, that little 60-second sound bite, basically there is the encapsulation and the explanation of why the world is falling apart in the fashion that it is right now, and as well as all of the other upheavals that have taken place, especially in the last century, as it relates to this particular group of people, this corrosive force, as our Hebraic author likes to refer to himself and to his people, this corrosive force on Gentile society. This is the reason that we find ourselves in the mess that we're in, folks, because quite simply, as I was having a discussion with a good friend of mine just about 15 minutes ago, and we were talking about, you know, the banking system in the West and how it is based upon usury and all of these things, and I explained to him, I said, before we can get around to the process of changing that banking system, the first thing we have to do is we have to destroy the foundation upon which that banking system is based, and that foundation is based upon the teachings of a particular book, which unfortunately billions of people around the world, mainly those who call themselves Christians, believe to be the Word of God. And it is within this book, and of course I'm talking about the Old Testament, and particularly the Torah, which is the first five books of Moses, where it very explicitly commands the children of Israel, or the Hebrews, or the Shebrews, or the Jews, or the whatever we want to call them, whatever combination of consonants and vowels we want to use in describing them, where it commands them that they are not to lend with interest on their own, but they're allowed to do this to the others, to us, to the Gentiles. And before we can get about the business of fixing these monumental problems that we're all facing right now, folks, we have to change the way we view the foundation of these problems, which is the thought processes that guide this corrosive force, as described by our Hebraic writer, Douglas Rushkoff. And I know for a lot of people this is a very difficult chasm to cross. They simply can't bring themselves to consider the possibility that, hey, maybe this is just a book. Just like the garbage that we see on TV, somebody sat down with a pen and a pad of paper or with a word processor, and they started composing something out of nothing, okay? There doesn't have to be any truth to it, or maybe just a very little bit of truth, okay? But it has this debilitating and paralyzing effect on an uncritical mind. You know, I have a good friend back east, and he sent me this joke, you know, because we're always joking with each other. You know, I always say, you know, if I won the lottery, I'd pay off all your debts, and I'd send you on a vacation to Hawaii or wherever, and he always does the same for me. So he bought a lottery ticket the other day, and he waited until they read off the lottery numbers, and then he scratched out all the numbers on his ticket, and he wrote the winning numbers on it, and he took a picture of it, and he said, hey, I won the lottery. And, you know, we laughed, and we got a good joke out of that. But actually, there was a great deal of truth and profundity to that little joke. because, in effect, our world right now is falling apart because of a group of people who have done exactly that. They have written out this winning lottery ticket in the form of this this horrible book known as the Old Testament, the Torah, whatever you want to call it, that features them as the winners of the ultimate lottery, God's chosen people. And, you know, if somebody were to do this, folks, if somebody were to take a lottery ticket like my friend did and scratch out, you know, the losing numbers and to write in the winning numbers and present that lottery ticket, you know, to the lottery commission or wherever, expecting to get $100 million or whatever, the best case scenario is that they would be laughed out of the store or out of the office. The worst case scenario is that they would be charged with attempted fraud. And yet this is precisely what took place thousands of years ago when some penniless, greedy person living in the middle of nowhere, the squalor of nowhere, sat down and started writing things down in creating their own winning lottery ticket. And that is the reason right now why the country, at least here the United States, is being ripped to shreds, why we have dealt with, in just in the last year, an impeachment and a pandemic and a collapsed economy and now a stolen election that who knows where it is going to end up. And it's all because of this fake lottery ticket, folks. Fake lottery ticket. So for the benefit of the new listeners to the program, and quite frankly for the benefit of those who are regular listeners, we need to think long and hard and deep on this topic. The only way we are going to begin the process of taking back what has been stolen from us is that the first thing that has to be done is that we have to detoxify our minds of any and all influences of this quote-unquote corrosive force. Remember, folks, those two words, corrosive force, are not my words. Those are the words of our non-Gentile writer, who's basically bragging about all of the chaos and problems that he and his cousins have created in Gentile society for thousands of years. Corrosive force. Now, if yours truly, or if our dear friend Mike Piper had said something like that, talked about this particular group of people being a corrosive force, of course, we would be accused of being bigots and neo-Nazis and haters and anti-Semites, of course. That's always the obligatory charge. But when they say it, and when they say it with a certain degree of, in a sneering, snickering way, you know, that we have been chewing away at your societies for thousands of years. Why? It's perfectly fine. It's perfectly fine. And as I said on the last program, folks, and which I will continue to say on all subsequent programs, as long as we are here and free to do this, we need to think long and hard about those particular words, because until people begin to understand the poison that is contained in those words, and not just the words of our friend Douglas Rushkoff, but literally in all of the ways in which that corrosive force has been implemented in our lives, through the media, through politics, through our banking system. It's everywhere, folks. It's like I used to say on my program years ago, you know, the problem of organized Jewish power, it's everywhere. It's in the air, it's in the water, it's even in our toothpaste, okay? And not until we begin the process of thinking like Gentiles, like the Gentiles that we are, and understanding that, you know, there's a big difference between sheep and wolves, okay? They're not meant to coexist. Until we begin to understand that, we're just going to watch as our world just continues to be ripped apart piece by piece. Let's see. Anyway, folks, just a few, just one quick digression. You know, in the midst of all of this upheaval that we're dealing with, especially today with the election, I'd like to remind you, and for those of you who aren't aware of what it is, to give you an explanation of what Hanukkah is. Right now, the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jews, whatever word we want to use in describing them, they are in the midst of their yearly celebration of Hanukkah. They have been celebrating this this religious festival for thousands of years. And, of course, just like everything else, the way that they present it, it's just this harmful thing. It's the festival of lights. And it's like Jewish Christmas. And I'm going to, after I put the program up for listening, I'm going to repost some older articles that we have run on the website that I was able to salvage, thank God, before everything was just ripped down, dealing with exactly what Hanukkah is. And this, I think, underscores why we do find ourselves at such a state of hopelessness with regards to these people. As I said, you know, Hanukkah, or as our good friend Mike Piper used to call it, Hanukkah, in a very disparaging way, it's not this harmless thing like Christmas is. I mean, for Christians and for Muslims, by the way, Christmas is this season of celebration over the birth of a good man who did nothing but bring good words and good works to people. Okay, he never screwed anybody over. He never cheated from anyone. He never stole from anyone. He never engaged in false witness. He never murdered anybody. He gave his life in service of speaking the truth to those who were willing to hear it. That's what we celebrate at Christmas. At Hanukkah, folks, or Hanukkah, as our good friend Mike Piper used to call it, they celebrate the butchery and the destruction of the Greek Empire. Particularly the Seleucid Empire in Syria. The storyline goes as thus. When Alexander the Great from Greece, he went through and brought Greece and Greek culture to the Middle East. The Jews, being the very backwards people that they were, don't forget, folks, as part of their religion, one of the 613 lashes, that's what I like to refer to it now. We always hear about how these horrible Muslims, they engage in capital punishment of people by giving them 40 lashes. Well, this is what I refer to. This is how I describe the 613 rules that the Jew is supposed to follow according to the law of Moses. 613 lashes. One of those lashes I like to point out to people and underscoring just what an insane philosophy it is that has driven these people to the fits of madness that has typified their behavior for thousands of years. Just one of those rules is that anyone who is caught picking up sticks on the Sabbath in order to build a fire for himself to cook his food or to heat his home, he's to be taken out and stoned to death for picking up sticks. The other one that I like to point out in underscoring the mental illness that unfortunately plagues these people as a result of the 613 lashes of Moses is that if a woman if her husband is suddenly set upon by let's say two or three robbers. And, you know, they're just beating the tar out of him. And she rushes in, the brave wife that she is, rushes in to try to protect her husband. And in the midst of this melee, if she accidentally reaches down and, you know, when all of this fighting is going on, you know, arms and legs and hands and fists going everywhere, if she accidentally reaches down in the interest of trying to protect her husband and grabs him accidentally by the genitals, then that hand has to be cut off. I'm not making this up, folks. You can go right to, I think it's either Deuteronomy or Leviticus. You can read it for yourself. But anyway, when the Greeks arrived and they brought with them, you know, what was the high culture of Greece, art and beauty and logic and all of these things, a lot of these Jews who had had enough of the 613 lashes and all of the rules and regulations about who was to be stoned to death and who wasn't, they, you know, they were pulled in favor of Greece and of Greek culture and beauty and philosophy. And, you know, Judaism began to lose its effect over the people. Well, the overlords simply couldn't allow that to happen. To have their people lose their Judaism in favor of becoming Gentiles. And so what happened is that this group of, well, we'll just call them what they are, folks. They were jihadists. You know, we hear all about jihad and about how the Muslims, these dark-skinned, swarthy, fundamentalist, backwards Muslims with their long beards and their swords, and they go out and they kill people who don't subscribe to their version of Islam. Well, that's a jihadist. Well, a jihadist obviously is somebody who meets the same description, the same qualification, except instead of doing it for Islam, they're doing it for Judaism. Okay, and that's what the Maccabees were, this group of jihadists who they rose up against the Greeks who were polluting the purity of Jewish society. And then they went on the rampage and they began slaughtering those Jews who had fallen away from their Judaism and were embracing Greek culture. And so this is what the Jews celebrate at Hanukkah, or Hanukkah as Mike Piper used to call it, every year, folks. It was a bloodbath. It was the equivalent of ISIS, okay, with their beheadings and their honor killings and all of the rest of that. But you see how it just gets twisted around, okay? ISIS, you know, we view them as terrorists for what they do. But these Jews from back during the time of the Greek Empire, they did it, and they're celebrated as heroes. And by the way, folks, just so that everybody understands the modern-day significance of this, because it's not just Hanukkah, the State of Israel, its emblem, is the symbol of the Maccabees, the menorah. That's why the menorah, that is the symbol of Israel. And the reason that they chose that for their national emblem was out of reverence for what the Maccabees did in destroying Greek influence in the Middle East. Now, let's bring this just a little bit closer to home, folks, because this is basically an extension or at least a connection to what is going on right now. And I'm not talking about it being the season of Hanukkah, but rather the fact that our president, and remember, folks, when we talk about the West, we are talking about the modern-day equivalent of the Roman Empire and Roman civilization. Our system of government is Roman. Our lifestyle in the West is Roman. Our languages are based off of Latin, some to a stronger degree than others, okay? Here in the United States, particularly our system of government, the Senate is a Roman institution. In fact, if you go to the U.S. Senate in Washington, D.C., you will see very, very overtly Roman symbols, including the fasci, okay, which was the bundle of sticks tied around the axe that represented the government's power to declare war, to make war, and to execute people, to bring justice. Of course, the symbol of the United States being the eagle, that was the symbol of Rome. And Rome, folks, was just the continuation of Greek culture. Greek culture. So this is very important to bring it into context, because I can guarantee you, folks, whether or not it is discussed out in the open or not. Amongst the rabbis, particularly in Israel, they are sitting back and they're watching all of the mayhem that's taking place in the United States, especially in the last year and especially in the last 4 years. They're looking at all of this and they are snickering to themselves and giggling and looking at all of the mess that they, as this corrosive force, have caused through their control of the media, through their control of the narrative, through their control of Congress that has been hounding this president for the last 4 years. And again, folks, revisiting the theme that is part of this program, it all goes back to what we have been discussing, which is Donald Trump's plans of bringing law and order to the Middle East before it blows up into World War III. Now, on that note, folks, I'm going to play a sound clip that is going to function as the springboard for the rest of today's discussion. So just sit back here for just a moment and take a listen.
Now, we're going to take a couple of questions, I know, but again, I would like to say in closing, Mr. Prime Minister, I appreciate the courage you showed at Wye, your farsightedness in seeking peace and in taking personal and political risks for it, which should now be readily apparent to anyone who has followed the events of the last 6 weeks. Your determination, your tenacity to build an Israel that is both secure and at peace is something that I admire and support. And I think if we keep working at it, we can keep making progress. Thank you very much.
Dansa Mama, Channel 1, please.
Mr. President, what is your reaction to the decision of the Judiciary Committee of the House yesterday? Do you intend to resign as did President Nixon?
My reaction to the committee vote is that I wasn't surprised. I think it's been obvious to anyone who is following it for weeks that that vote was foreordained. And now it is up to the members of the House of Representatives to vote their conscience on the Constitution and the law, which I believe are clear. And I have no intention of resigning. It's never crossed my mind.
Mr. President, how confident are you that you can avoid impeachment in the full House next weekend? Are you planning any particular kind of outreach additional to lawmakers or the public?
Well, I think it's up to the question of whether each member will simply vote his or her conscience based on the Constitution and the law. And I don't know what's going to happen. That's up to them. It's out of my hands. If any member wishes to talk to me or someone on my staff, we would make ourselves available to them. But otherwise, I think it's important that they be free to make this decision and that they not be put under any undue pressure from any quarter. Many of them have said they feel such pressure, but I can't comment on that because I haven't talked directly to many members of the House caucus, the Republican caucus, and I have talked to those few who said they wanted to talk to me. Otherwise, I have not. I don't think it's appropriate for me to be personally calling people unless they send word to me that there's some question they want to ask or something they want to say. I don't think it's appropriate.
Emmanuel Rosen, Israel Channel 2.
Mr. President, you said that now it's up to the members of the House to decide.
May I ask a favor, just a question? You're free to ask any one of your questions, but I think the president has come here on a very clear message, mm-hmm. on a very clear voyage of peace, and I believe that it would be appropriate also to ask one or two questions on the peace process. I would like to know the answers to.
This will be exactly my second question. The first one is about what will happen Thursday. If the members of the House will decide about impeachment, if in this case whether you will consider resignation. And second question, about the peace process. After all what you see now, after you hear the Prime Minister Don't you think you were wrong in the Y memorandum? Don't you think that you get an agreement which both sides cannot comply?
Okay, folks, so that was none other than William Jefferson Clinton, Slick Willie, President of the United States. And the circumstances of that soundbite were that Clinton, in 1998, he flew to Israel in order to push his peace deal. This peace deal was not his baby. It was just the continuation of the same parameters and protocols that had been left undone by George H.W. Bush before he was thrown out of office by that corrosive force. And even Bush's peace deal plans were not his. They were the plans that had been left for him by Ronald Reagan, who wasn't able to go forward with his plans because of various things, not the least of which was Iran-Contra. And it wasn't Reagan's plans either, folks, because Reagan had picked up where Jimmy Carter had left off with the Camp David Agreement. Okay, he had pushed through the first part, which was to get the Sinai returned to Egypt. And then he was just getting ready to start on the second part, which would have forced the Israelis to give up the land that they had stolen in 1967. And then all of a sudden, we find ourselves with a bad economy, and then the hostage situation with Iran, and then Carter is removed. But it wasn't Carter's plans either, folks, because he inherited this from Gerald Ford, who also did not get reelected because of a bad economy. And it wasn't even Ford's plan either, folks. It all began with Richard Nixon. It was Nixon's plan for forcing Israel to give the lands back, according to UN Resolution 242, that she had stolen in 67, that had made its way like a baton that is passed off in one of these marathon races. You know, one, the first one's carrying it, and then he hands it off to the next guy, and he carries it, and on and on and on. Started with Nixon. Nixon was not able to go forward with it because of Watergate. So Clinton actually did make a lot of progress in this regard, folks, and he would have finished it were it not for the Lewinsky scandal. Now, interestingly enough, the circumstances surrounding this little soundbite that you heard. Clinton is on his way to Israel, and literally upon landing at Ben Gurion Airport, literally as soon as the wheels touch down, he finds out that the House Judiciary Committee had just voted on and passed the articles of impeachment against him. I'm sure it was just a coincidence, folks. I'm sure that Benjamin Netanyahu and his control, his tentacled control of the House of Representatives had absolutely nothing to do with the timing of that. Obviously, I'm being sarcastic about that. Of course, Benjamin Netanyahu had everything to do with it. He wanted to make sure that the moment that Clinton touched down in Israel, his legs had already been politically broken. Now, this particular soundbite, it was a press conference, and I think they had it right there at the airport. And as I said, Clinton was there to push his peace deal. He had just found out that they had voted on these articles of impeachment. And if you look at the video, folks, which I did post on the website earlier this week, Clinton looks like he just got jumped by a bunch of guys and had the hell beat out of him. He had no energy. He had no enthusiasm. And this is exactly what Benjamin Netanyahu wanted. So when they got around to asking the questions, you know, remember, he's there to to push his peace deal. He's not there to talk about the articles of impeachment that had just been voted against him. You can see that this was all a setup, folks. And it's an established fact now. I mean, it's a fact that is even discussed within the Israeli press itself, that the entire Lewinsky scandal that ended up with Clinton being impeached, that this was an Israeli intelligence operation run by Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, the reason that I chose this, folks, this soundbite, is because if you listen to the exchange that takes place, Clinton and Netanyahu are very cordial to each other, very cordial, very friendly, laughing and shaking hands and ha 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 and all the rest of that stuff. But Clinton knows that Netanyahu is the one responsible for doing this. In fact, Netanyahu made this clear to him literally in a face-to-face discussion between him and the president when they were at the Y River plantation in Maryland, hammering out the details of this peace deal that Clinton was pushing forward with Oslo, the Oslo Accord. Netanyahu came up to him and he said, by the way, Mr. President, we have 30 hours of recorded phone conversations between you and Monica Lewinsky, but don't worry, we're not going to go public with them. This is in the Israeli press, folks. You can read this yourself. It's an established fact. It's not a theory. Benjamin Netanyahu ran this intelligence operation aimed at breaking Clinton's legs politically so that he could not push forward any further this peace deal that would have forced Israel to abide by the terms of UN Resolution 242, which meant giving up the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and Gaza. Now, the reason I point this out is because for the last 4 years or so, folks, yours truly has had to do a lot of arguing and squabbling and explaining to a lot of people who believe what they see when they see Trump and Netanyahu shaking hands and smiling and, you know, this air of what appears to be mutual affection for each other, and they don't even stop and think for a minute that maybe this isn't the case at all. Maybe this is just politics, and this is what has to be done, and then what happens behind closed doors when the mics are off and the cameras are off is a completely different thing altogether. Interestingly, folks, if you go back and watch that video, that section where Clinton is talking about pressure being put on members of Congress to vote to impeach him, if you watch carefully, his eyes dart to his left where Netanyahu is standing. He doesn't look directly at Netanyahu, but he made it a point to coincide his discussing the outside pressure that is being put on members of Congress to engage in this political hit against him by outside forces. Now, this is important to note because, you know, a lot of people listening to this program or reading the things on the website are saying to themselves, well, okay, so, you know, I've been looking around. I've been looking for Trump saying something indicating his disfavor with Netanyahu, or Netanyahu indicating his disfavor with Trump over this peace deal that Trump wants to push through in the Middle East. And I just can't find anything. All I see are these news stories and video clips of the two shaking hands, and they're all good friends and all the rest of that. Yes, 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 I know. I understand. Okay, just like it was with Clinton and Netanyahu. You know, there weren't any, there was no spitting at each other. There was no calling each other names. You know, they put on this show, this performance for everybody around to watch for themselves. But they and everybody else there knew exactly what the nature of the game is. Now, let's bring this thing fast forward to today, folks. Donald J. Trump and what has been the unprecedented amount of political instability and this wall of noise pollution for the last 5 years. This has not been generated because Trump happens to be a Christian. It's not because he happens to be a conservative. It's not because he happens to be a capitalist. It's not about racism. It's not about a border wall. It's not about immigrants. It's not about, a trade deal with China. It's all about two sides of one coin. On one side of the coin is this word known as war. On the other side of the coin is this word known as peace. From its inception, and I don't mean in 1948, I mean going back thousands of years, the entire paradigm of creating this Hebraic state, whatever we want to call it, has been one based upon conquest and war. It's about stealing from other people what belonged to them, and all of this justified by this winning lottery ticket that has the winning numbers scribbled into it. Here's our land deed. Here's proof that we own the land, and here is the legal justification for us to take from you what is yours, and if you try and resist us in doing so, the right on our part to kill you. Their own winning, self-written lottery ticket, folks. Now, again, bring this back to the original point where we began discussing this. Until people begin this process of studying this corrosive force as our unesteemed Hebraic writer Rushkoff says, until we begin studying this thing, this corrosive force at the, not even just the cellular level, folks, it's got to be down to the subatomic level. Until we begin understanding this, studying it, understanding it, viewing it for what it is, and, you know, looking at that lottery ticket and saying, you know, maybe it's just me, but it looks like somebody might have scratched out the old numbers and they wrote in these other ones with crayons. Maybe this isn't a real ticket. Until we begin this process of detoxifying ourselves of this corrosive, of the effects of this corrosive force, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse, folks. And, you know, if this were this corrosive force, if it were just limited to some little community of, you know, Amish type people living out in the middle of Ohio or Pennsylvania, and they didn't have the kind of control over the media and over our money and our politicians and everything else, then I would say, fine, let the corrosive force stay there and let it just eat itself away until it doesn't even exist anymore. But obviously this isn't the case, okay? And until we begin this process, folks, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. Now, I'm going to switch gears. I don't know if you'd say it a little bit or drastically. It's probably a little bit of both. But the other topic that I wanted to cover today, because it really just hit me this week as I was continuing the research that I've been doing on this book. I was contacted by an Iranian media outlet a couple of weeks ago, and they've been wanting to interview me about General Qasem Soleimani, who, as we have been told, was killed almost a year ago in a drone strike supposedly ordered by President Trump. And the justification that was given for this was that Soleimani was supposedly planning some attacks against American forces in Iraq, and therefore he was taken out before he could do this. Now, I was immediately I won't say that I was suspicious, folks. I mean, everything that has happened, and you know, Trump's military actions have been very, very few and far between in the last 4 years. He really hasn't done much at all. When we look at the absolutely apocalyptic bloodbath perpetrated by the little monkey in the White House at that time, George W. Bush, and then we look at what his successor, Barack Obama, did with the Arab Spring and with the use of drones and, of course, the complete obliteration of Libya and the murder of its leader, Muammar Gaddafi. And then you compare all of that to the relatively little military actions that that President Trump has overseen in the last 4 years. I mean, it really, you can count them really on one hand, what Trump has done. And so I was a little bit suspicious of this killing of Soleimani. And I made this this clear in this interview that I did. And I said, well, if indeed Soleimani was killed, and they said, well, what do you mean if? And I said, well, if. I said, if it was Soleimani. And they said, well, it was. And I said, well, what proof have we been given that it was him? And, you know, a reader, a good friend of mine, he warned me earlier this week. He said, you got to be careful, or last week, you got to be careful. They're going to accuse you of being a, what did he call it? A Soleimani hoaxer or something like that, you know, claiming that Soleimani wasn't killed. And I said, well, you know, I'm not claiming that he wasn't. I'm not even theorizing that he wasn't. I'm merely asking the question, is have we been given all of the facts? And I pointed out on this interview, I said, you know, the only proof that we have that Soleimani was in the car is this hand, this severed hand that was found at the scene with his ring on it. You know, and he, you can look up on the internet, folks, that there's this big ring that he wore, I think on his left hand. Big ring, very much part of his personification and his signature is this ring, and this is the proof that they have used that Soleimani was in that vehicle that was hit by the drone strike. Well, after the and in the interview, I said, look, all I'm saying is I don't know for sure that it was the general because as far as I know, the only proof that we have. Is this severed hand that doesn't have any lacerations on it, folks. You know, years and years ago, I was reloading some ammunition because I did that at the time where I would make my own ammunition. And I had a tray of primers explode in my hand. And it just shredded my hand to pieces. Okay. I had to go to the hospital and I had to get a lot of stitches in it. And was there for a good 3 or 4 hours as they were repairing all of the cuts and lacerations on my hand. Well, this was not this was not the kind of explosion that you would go through in a drone strike. And yet that hand, other than it having some dirt on it, it was pretty much intact. You know, the skin was all there. All the fingers were there. The thumb was there. And then there was that ring. Well, out of curiosity, I said, you know, I'm just going to, you know, after the interview was over, I said, I'm going to go back and I'm going to look up that picture of that hand with the ring on it. And sure enough, folks, sure enough, the picture of the hand that was broadcast all over the world as proof that Soleimani had been killed in that airstrike, the ring that was on that hand was completely different than the ring that he was known to wear and that you can see in the various pictures. Now, is it possible that he had more than one ring? Yes, it is possible. And as I said at this point, I'm not theorizing or stating that I definitively believe that Soleimani wasn't killed, but I find it very interesting that the rings bore some similarity to each other. You know, they were these two very large dark stones. But if you look at the I think it's called the crown. That's the part that holds the stone in the ring. The two rings are completely different. Completely different. So I, since that time, folks, since that interview, I have been playing out in my mind this little exercise that we used to do when I was a history major in college, and it was known as what if. What if? And, you know, the object of the exercise in the history class is, what if this didn't happen, and what if that didn't happen? How would this have changed history as we know it today? You know, and there's that old saying, you know, for want of a nail. You know, I think the saying goes, for want of a nail, the horseshoe fell off the horse, and because the horse lost the horseshoe, the horse was lame, and then the horse fell with the general on it, and because of the lack of a simple nail in that horseshoe, the general lost the war, or something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing it. So in this case, folks, what if? We're just going to start off our little question here, not a theory or a hypothesis, but just a question. What if? What if Soleimani wasn't killed? What if he was snatched by what's known as a snatch team in the CIA? Because it would not have been in Trump's interest at all to kill somebody who literally is more beloved in Iran than the supreme leader himself. It would not be in his interest to do such a thing if he is trying to avoid a war in the Middle East, and especially a war with Iran, to kill somebody that important and that beloved as Soleimani. Now, the other option, the other possibility is that the drone strike took place without Trump's approval, because, as I explained in this interview, the chain of command as it exists in the U.S. military, the field commanders are given a great amount of leeway to call in strikes on certain targets, and they don't have to go all the way up. They're given pre-approval from national command authority to engage in certain strikes. And of course, at the same time, folks, we also have to remember that when we talk about the deep state that has been working against the president, we're not just talking about the media, we're talking about the CIA, our intelligence services, and even many of the upper echelons within the military establishment. Okay, people who were co-opted and compromised decades ago by Israel, and who wear the uniform of an American general or an American admiral or whatever, but who are taking their orders from Israel. So if Israel wanted to get a war started between America and Iran, all they would have to do is to pick up the phone and to call whoever happens to be on their payroll who has the authority to order a drone strike, absent the president's explicit order to do so, and to kill Soleimani to do it. Okay? I mean, clearly it is in Israel's interest to do such a thing, since Trump does 100% plan, not hope, but plans to work out a deal with the Iranians. So it would be in Israel's interest, for sure, to see Soleimani killed and to have the blame for that land in Trump's lap in order to completely obliterate his chances for working out a deal with Iran, which he plans to do. The other alternative, the other possibility, folks, is that Trump ordered Soleimani snatched. Snatched. Now, you're saying to yourself, asking yourself, okay, well, why would he want to do such a thing? Okay, what if, folks... Remember, that's the name of the little game that we're playing here, is what if. What if Trump plans to bring Soleimani back from the dead, like Jesus raising Lazarus? And by the way, folks, just for historical reference, it was Jesus' raising Lazarus from the dead that sealed Jesus' fate as far as the Jewish leadership goes. If you read in the Gospels, after Jesus has just raised Lazarus from the dead, the Goombas of La Kosher Nostra in Israel at the time, they get together, these rabbis, and they're in panic mode, and they're saying, what are we going to do? Here's this man performing all of these great miracles, and we can't even begin to approach doing anything like this. And it was Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, who said, you fools, you do not know anything. Do you not understand that it is better for one man to die than it is for us to lose an entire nation? Now, I'm not comparing Donald Trump to Jesus Christ. But if Trump were to bring Soleimani back from the dead as a gift to the Iranian people, especially now during the Christmas season, folks, because for those of you who aren't aware of it, our celebration of Christmas was a gift to the West by the Iranians, the three wise men who brought gifts to the newborn baby Jesus came from Persia. Christmas began with the Iranians. And I think that it is a possibility, that maybe this is exactly what Trump was planning to do and is planning to do as the means of establishing goodwill, showing his goodwill and his good faith towards the Iranian people, to say, look, a year ago, 2,000 years ago, you gave us the gift of Christmas. Now, I would like to reciprocate that by giving you back your general, Soleimani. And, of course, the outrage and the uproar would be, what is this? Some kind of cheap political trick or whatever. But what if, folks, since we're playing that game, what if Trump's response to that is, look, we got word that Israel was planning to assassinate him. And we knew that this would have started off possibly World War III. And since General Soleimani has been so instrumental in helping liberate Syria from ISIS, then we thought it fitting to save him from the planned assassination. Yes, folks, I realize that it is something of a stretch. But then again, we have to remember that this is Donald J. Trump, who loves pulling rabbits out of magic hats and saying, hey, everybody, look at this. Did you think that this was coming? His entire Middle East policy and his entire Middle East posture, that is exactly what it has been. Now, the other thing that hit me, folks, relative to this what-if exercise involving Soleimani, and, you know, we have talked about it many times, but we've just kind of let it roll off of our tongues without really thinking about the bigger implications that are associated with it. Iran is the prize. The reason for Iraq being destroyed first, I want you to, if you have it, have it in front of you, folks, to pull up a map of the Middle East and look at where Iraq is. Because remember, after 9/11, you know, Iraq was the one. Forget about Afghanistan. Forget about anybody else who might have been involved in it. No. We got to go in, and we've got to go into Iraq. Now, of course, part of that was that the neocons wanted to capitalize on the emotional energy that was associated with that because of what George H.W. Bush did. You know, he fought this 45-day war that, it was over and done with, and with relatively little loss of American life, and so they wanted to capitalize on that. But there's also, I think, a more important strategic reason for that, folks, which is that Iraq is right in the middle of the Middle East. You put a bunch of American or NATO troops in Iraq, and if you want to start a war with the Arabs, you simply turn west. You turn your forces west. And if you want to start a war with Iran, You simply turn your forces east. And clearly, this was what the neocons wanted back then, 20 years ago. Because when George W. Bush, the little monkey in the White House, gave his famous speech where he talked about the axis of evil, he listed Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Iran is the plum, folks. Iran is the plum for many reasons, not the least of which is that it is militarily the most powerful of the countries in the Middle East there. Obviously, absent Pakistan with her nukes. But Iran is a very, very powerful country militarily. Iran and the Jews, the corrosive force, they intend to get that war with Iran started. Now, how are they going to be able to do that if Trump brings Soleimani back from the dead, gives him to the Iranian people? The Iranian people no longer see the United States as the great Satan, and now we're talking about making a peace deal with Iran. How are the Jews going to get, how are they going to pick that plum off of the tree? Yes, folks, I realize it's a game of what if, or an exercise of what if. And it is a stretch, but I think it is a question at least worth asking. Now, I'm going to touch on one quick news story here. Actually, it's just an op-ed. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it because we are reaching the one-hour mark. And as I have said often, I don't want to do more than an hour. I don't want to take up more than an hour of your time. Anyway, this is a piece that appeared on Haaretz, a very high circulation news website in Israel. And the title of it is Why Israel Settlers Are Not Afraid of a Joe Biden Presidency. Now, again, folks, at the risk of beating a dead horse here, this is my thesis. And yes, folks, I think out of all the 7 billion people on the planet, I think there's one lonely guy. Not lonely, folks. Obviously, I've got a beautiful wife and a bunch of kids. But one lone guy who has offered this as the explanation as to why there is this seek and destroy mission against a certain Donald J. Trump. And it is because of his plans, two-pronged plans. Number one is to bring peace to the Middle East, and number two, to stop all of the wars. Just like a plug that you plug into the wall with those two prongs, you know. Both of them have to be there in order for this thing to function. And so you can't understand what is this seek and destroy mission against Donald Trump without understanding those two concepts, those two opposing concepts of peace and war. He comes not as a war maker, but as a peacemaker. And that's why he has to go, because we are dealing with a theocratic, jihadist political entity that absolutely cannot exist in a war-absent environment. It has to have war in order to feed itself. Anyway, this article entitled Why Israel Settlers Are Not Afraid of a Joe Biden Presidency. Now, you know, the narrative for the last 4 years has been, oh, Trump is totally in bed with Netanyahu, and especially with the right wing. He's given him so much. He's given him Jerusalem. He moved the embassy, and he gave him the Golan Heights, blah, 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 blah. That's true, folks. He has done that. He broke with the tradition of failed attempts in the past, going all the way back to Nixon. And he said, you know, we're not going to do this UN Resolution 242 thing. What we're going to do is we're going to tell these Jews, look, you've got your Golan Heights, you've got the West Bank, at least, you know, the settlements, and you've got Jerusalem, and that's it. You're not getting any more. Forget about all of this Eretz Israel, Greater Israel business, you know, from the Nile to the Euphrates. Forget about it. this is it. Here's your peace deal. And I'm sure that Trump has made it clear to Netanyahu and his base of support, which is the settlers, okay, that if they don't play ball, then nasty things are going to happen. The first of which is they're going to lose their financial support from America. But even more dangerous than that, folks, was the tweet that Trump sent out today where he threatened to declassify everything. Now, all of this was done within the context of them attempting to steal this election. But Trump was very very vague about it when he said that he would declassify everything. So what are we talking about when we talk about declassifying everything? We're talking about who killed JFK. We're talking about Israel's attack on the USS Liberty. We're talking about 9/11, Oklahoma City. A whole bunch of really nasty things that the American people know little about, if anything. And that is the ace that Trump has been holding, actually the ace of spades that he has been holding up his sleeve all along. And we can all rest assured that if it comes down to it, if he finds it necessary in this high-stakes game of poker, that he has to throw that ace of spades down, he's going to do it, folks. And especially when it comes to Netanyahu and the settlers. Now, this particular piece, I'm going to touch on it very quickly, and then I'm going to cut everybody loose. Again, it's entitled, Why Israel Settlers Aren't Afraid of a Joe Biden Presidency. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing, folks. I'm going to read some of the sections in it where our unesteemed Hebraic author here is accurately, I would say, analyzing why Joe Biden doesn't pose any kind of threat whatsoever to Israel's plans in the Middle East. One of the things that this article and a few others that I have posted in the last couple days has said is that Biden plans to deprioritize bringing any peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. And you know why, folks? Because this was the deal he made with Netanyahu and the rest of the gang in order to secure their support for him winning the presidency. He made this deal. Yeah, fine. No peace deal. And, you know, we'll let things settle down a little bit after the election. And then, yeah, go ahead and blow something up and we'll get the wars started up all over again that were put on pause or really came to a screeching halt right after Donald Trump was elected. Now, let's see. I'm just going to read a few, I guess we would call them pull quotes from the piece. Our unesteemed Hebraic author writes, in some ways, the Biden presidency will be a return to the Obama era, where little was done to actually halt, let alone reverse, the expansion of illegal settlement in the West Bank. And then he goes on to talk about, the United States under a Biden presidency will return to a slightly more critical, meaning cheap words, folks, slightly more critical but overall supportive position towards Israel while trying to expand on Trump's Abraham Accords. Those are the peace deals that Trump negotiated between the various Arab Gulf states and Israel. The Biden administration will disregard the rest of Trump's largely ignored Peace for Prosperity plan. That's the deal with the Palestinians. Let's see. Yes, the settlers were outspoken supporters of Trump, but most of its leaders actually rejected Trump's carefully modulated support for partial annexation of the West Bank because it still was not enough. In fact, one of the heads recently called the Abraham Accords, with their precondition of an annexation freeze in the West Bank, quote, a scam, and even stated that Trump is no friend of Israel. And finally, folks, the last paragraph I'm going to quote in this piece, very, very important, and particularly for two words that you're going to hear. Our Hebraic writer states, while the settlers may have wanted Trump, they will be fine under Biden. They will lose the unprecedented support from both the U.S. president and the U.S. ambassador, but they will also regain a great deal of independence from them. Even Trump would not have supported the full annexation of Eretz Israel, and the settler movement won't settle for anything less. Now, the reason that this is important, folks, is because that settler movement represents 80% of Benjamin Netanyahu's base of support in Israel. Okay. That's his bread, his political bread and butter. If Trump's biggest base of support in America are the Christian evangelicals, Netanyahu's biggest base of support are the settlers. And the settlers are absolutely furious with Trump's plans for the creation of a Palestinian state. And those of you who have followed the website know that we have, day after day for years, ever since Trump first said the three words, ultimate peace deal, that we have hyper-focused the reaction, the visceral, volcanic reaction on the part of the settler movement towards Trump's plans for bringing peace. And, of course, the dots that have to be connected in all of this is to translate those volcanic, that volcanic opposition on the part of that settler base to Netanyahu, and what Netanyahu then puts into practice using his influence in the United States Congress, in the mainstream media mafia, and all of the other tentacles which he has at his disposal, in order to try and bring down Donald Trump before he can seal the deal. So anyway, folks, I realize I had to squash, I squashed a lot of information. We're already in an hour and 7 minutes here. I've got to get going. I realize I squashed a lot into one program. For those of you who are wondering what is next, I will just reiterate what I said on one of the former programs, which is I think that the crud is going to hit the fan. As of this moment, folks, on January the 20th, when you know the new president is supposed to be inaugurated, I predict that Donald J. Trump is still going to be at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, whether he is there because this has been adjudicated and it has been fixed and he is legally the president, or whether he is forced by circumstances to remain there as commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States because we happen to find ourselves in the midst of a national meltdown, either because of the riots or because of military actions on the part of China fomenting the riots here, or whether we see huge, big, fat wars beginning in the Far East by the Chinese and in the Middle East by Israel. I still, at this point, when I look toward January the 20th, I see Trump still sitting in the White House. Either way, folks, what we have in front of us is a big, big mess. And I realize that this is, you know, anybody who's looking for a solution to this problem, the solution should have been started, folks, 2,000 years ago, when rational people should have put this corrosive force under the microscope of human reasoning and studied this lottery ticket, this fake lottery ticket, and deduced it for what it was, which was forgery and fraud. And then we wouldn't be where we are now with all of this. So anyway, folks, that's it for tonight. I thank you for your patience. Again, anybody who would like to assist with the costs associated with producing this fine program, that I don't think it's a stretch at all, folks, to say that you're not going to hear a lot of this discussion anywhere else but here. Anybody who would like to assist with the costs associated with this, simply send me an email at theuglytruthradioprogram@gmail.com, and I will set you on the path of righteousness and enlightenment. Until we meet again, folks, God willing, stay safe, stay sharp, and we'll see you again.